Hello. On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles Gustavo Dudamel. The dynamic young conductor leads the Israel Philharmonic in a Kimmel Center concert on Wednesday. Jason Pfeiffer explores the role and history of the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen, a 64-year-old organization dedicated to preserving and promoting fine crafts. Susan Lewis looks at Intercultural Journeys, a group that promotes cross-cultural understanding through music. And Tom Keels explores changes to the Kimmel Center's Commonwealth Plaza. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Whenever you hear this music these days, chances are that the Venezuelan conductor Gustavo Dudamel can't be far away. But Leonard Bernstein's symphonic Mambo is one musical calling card that Dudamel won't be playing in his Philadelphia debut with the Israel Philharmonic Wednesday at the Kimmel Center. That's reserved for much wilder Bernstein, his almost never heard concerto for orchestra. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met up with this hot young conductor in New York City yesterday.
Difficulty is like a magnet for Gustavo Dudamel. The 27-year-old conductor is one of the very few to go anywhere near Leonard Bernstein's Concerto for Orchestra, also known as Jubilee Games, since the composer completed the piece in the few years prior to his 1990 death. Even performances led by Bernstein himself, as was this one, didn't always come off due to his repeated requests for orchestral improvisation. But having discovered the piece in recent months, Dudamel wasn't going to let anything stop him from making it dance.
I'm in love with the piece. It's a very deep Bernstein, because you have everything. You have all the Bernstein elements with all the knowledge of time. And then you have this first movement you can think that is, you can say Penderecki, or a modern composer, or less some sounds that you don't understand. We have to put this piece like in the same level of the symphonies, because it's a wonderful piece.
The irresistible energy that Dudamel brings to classical music has landed him, only 3 years into his international career, two major positions. Last year, he was named principal conductor of Sweden's Gothenburg Symphony. Next year, he becomes music director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Already, he has a recording contract with Deutsche Grammophon. Repertoire that conductors save for advanced maturity is firmly embedded in Gustavo Dudamel's programs. In fact, he seems decidedly attracted to late-period works that look back with wisdom. Besides the Bernstein Concerto, Dudamel's current Israel Philharmonic tour also includes the elegiac Brahms Symphony No. 4. His emotional range is broad and intense. If there's a blind spot in his inner life, though, it is perhaps a healthy sense of fear. He seems not to experience it. It's possible, though, that we can't imagine the South American world that he came out of. Though trained as a violinist, he aspired to conduct at an early age and had plenty of opportunities in Venezuela's remarkable network of youth orchestras, most notably the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra that draws youngsters even from the hinterlands. To them, Beethoven isn't some monument carved into the face of a mountain, but an almost living presence, a talisman, a godfather, a focal point for celebration, victory, and all manner of jubilation.
His music is so powerful. And when a kid, you put an instrument in the hands of a kid, and he plays for the first time Beethoven Fifth, for example, it's a symbol of the destiny, you know, of, oh my God, I'm playing. For me, it was amazing when I was playing Beethoven Fifth for the first time, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. The most beautiful example of this is I was one day playing a concert in my town with the Simón Bolívar Orchestra. We were 600, I think. You know, it was a huge orchestra. I remember that there were 8,000 or 9,000 people listening. And when we start, dun, 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 they were screaming, you know.
Thank you.
Pa.
When Gustavo Dudamel landed his Deutsche Grammophon recording contract, his first release in 2006 was this performance of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. By then, he had won the Gustav Mahler Conducting Prize in Germany and was being championed by Simon Rattle and Claudio Abbado. In 2005, he filled in for an alien Zubin Mehta with the Israel Philharmonic. It was his first major orchestral gig and a tough one. Even Bernstein once wrote a poem titled The Israel Philharmonic Blues. Today, the ever-playful Dudamel does inspired imitations of the sidelong glances the Israel players were giving each other at his first rehearsal. Now, he is said to be like family. Some of that is about his winning personality, but the pianist Leif Ove Andsnu speaks for many when he says that Dudamel knows all the things about conducting that can't be taught. So it's no wonder that Dudamel isn't easy to intimidate. Leading the Vienna Philharmonic in Mahler Symphony No. 1, however, came close.
When you are there in front, and the first cello player telling you, you know, my grandfather played with Mahler when the premiere and these kind of things, you are okay. This is something special, but let's enjoy.
Gustavo Dudamel claims his life hasn't really changed that much. He's always conducted a lot. He's just doing more of it outside of Venezuela. Still, starting a career at such a high pitch is always a bit dangerous. Where do you go from there? Into product endorsements, like Long Long? Dudamel's future is impossible to envision. But from the dozen or so live performances, recordings, videos, and webcasts I've monitored over the past few years, about half of them are pretty great. But when they're not, his music making still feels natural, blissfully unselfconscious, and unneurotic. I've never seen anything like him. And neither have you.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Gustavo Dudamel in Tuesday's paper. Dudamel leads the Israel Philharmonic in a program featuring works by Brahms and Bernstein at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Wednesday evening.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Guilds in one form or another have been around for centuries, from merchant and craft guilds in the Middle Ages to the Screen Actors Guild and Newspaper Guild of today. One of the oldest and largest craft guilds in the United States is the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen, an organization with 17 chapters and members from 29 different states. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, while the guild arose out of necessity, it is today an effective advocate for fine crafts.
The origins of the Pennsylvania Guild of Craftsmen can be traced back to the early 1940s, when the war effort demanded heavy use of the labor forces, natural resources, and industrial facilities of the country. The Pennsylvania Guild's executive director, Sherry Boyer, says First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt actively encouraged people to produce their own goods.
There was a nationwide call to citizens to be more self-sufficient.
Boyer says Roosevelt called on master craftspeople around the country to educate the general population on how to make their own clothes and other household items, like baskets, pottery, and furniture. So craftspeople banded together to provide instruction.
Some of the very first workshops that we offered were to teach women along the main line in Philadelphia how to comb certain breeds of dogs for their hair that they could then weave into yarn that they could then sew to make coats so that the wool could go to the armed forces.
Building on the momentum and unity of the war years, the Pennsylvania Craftsman Guild was established in 1944, dedicated to nurturing the craftsmen of the state and bringing their work to public attention. Sherry Boyer explains the guild represents the interests of a wide range of crafts: dolls, jewelry, leatherwork, wood carvings.
Craftsmanship is anything that is done with the hand, with assistance of the eye.
Another way the guild defines craftsmanship, according to its program manager, Nick Moeller, is as the manipulation of raw materials.
And that's kind of a broad explanation, but basically what it's trying to say is if you're making jewelry, if you're making a necklace, you are making all the parts of the necklace, the clasp, the pendant, everything involved. It's all the steps from start to finish.
I'm Scott Gold, and I make tableware from wood.
Seated on a stool with a block of wood at his feet during the Pennsylvania Guild's Holiday Fine Crafts Fair last weekend, Gold is making a medium-sized salad bowl out of cherry wood, cutting away the center of the serving dish with a traditional tool called a bowl adze.
Every craftsman that worked with wood had an adze designed for their particular purpose.
And how did you get into this?
My wife came home from a craft show about 20 years ago. She had purchased a bowl, and I thought she spent too much money for it. And I said, I think I can do that. And I did some research and made some tools and started.
Gold now sells his wooden tableware at craft fairs. The Pennsylvania Guild organizes three major fairs each year: the Holiday Fair, one in the summer, and another in early fall. These fairs grew out of an exhibition at the Art Alliance in Philadelphia in 1946, where thousands of people could look but not buy. Today, the fairs are venues for artisans to demonstrate and sell their work. For craftsmen like Mike Patterson, who makes trellises for climbing plants, decorative gardening tools, and landscape art, all out of steel, the guild fairs are critical.
It's sort of the machine that motivates most of my production, because I don't do any other shows except for the guild shows. If it weren't for the guild, I wouldn't have the need to generate this kind of inventory.
Patterson has been a guild member for 16 years and has been displaying and selling at the fairs for 14. A former welder at the National Science Foundation who made numerous trips to Antarctica, his creative work is now a full-time job, supported by customer appreciation for originality and the personal touch.
I think it's a love of something they can't buy anywhere else. It's only from the people who make it, or at a gallery perhaps that carries their work. And it gives the customer a chance to meet the person who actually created the piece, and that adds a lot to it.
To take part in the shows, craftsmen are required to be members of the guild and reapply annually with samples of their work. With hundreds of entries each year, Executive Director Sherry Boyer says upholding high standards for craftsmanship is another major function of the guild.
We offer a master craftsman status kind of program. It's called juried status, and you can go through a very rigorous critique by your peers and be awarded this status program. And it's quite an honor, and a lot of people vie for that and want to have that on their resume. They want to be able to apply for exhibitions in major museums, and being able to say that they're a master craftsman with the Pennsylvania Guild is a big deal.
While granting master status and organizing fairs is what the Guild is best known for, Boyer says its mission remains rooted in education.
That's the heart of who we are. We provide a lot of mentorships for folks and a lot of apprenticeships for people who are trying to learn. We offer about 100 workshops a year, and they are all over the state.
Teaching the fine crafts to younger people has become a priority. Program manager Nick Moeller says there's now a big push to attract emerging artists and a younger audience as an investment in the future.
Because a lot of universities and art schools aren't geared towards saying that this is a livelihood, this is a profession that you could take. But it is certainly a profession that an art student who is determined to improve the quality of their work, it's something that they can go into.
64 years after its creation, the Pennsylvania Craftsman Guild has well over 1,500 members and remains committed to promoting handcrafted goods and their creators. Although people no longer rely on crafts as a matter of necessity, interest in creating and consuming original, handcrafted baskets, jewelry, leather, quilts, and other works with a personal touch endures.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Today, information zips across the globe in seconds. Economies intersect and people around the world encounter others from different countries and traditions. Intercultural Journeys is a group that uses music and art to foster understanding between cultures. Its artistic director is Philadelphia orchestra cellist, Israeli native Udi Bar David, whose first collaboration about 10 years ago was with Palestinian musicians. He's also explored other cultures, among them Buddhist, African American, and Native American. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores Bar David's latest journey.
Arizona native R. Carlos Nakai has been on his own musical journey, creating music for flute derived from centuries-old Native American vocal music.
Without any written language, they utilized music, prose form, storytelling, and other, let's say, mnemonic devices to convey important information through time.
When Udi Bar David came into his life, Nakai had traveled to a point where he was eager to get into more chamber and orchestral work. Originally schooled in the trumpet, Nakai learned about his Navajo Ute heritage as a child. As a young adult, he explored traditional music making in singing and drums, eventually picking up the wooden flute, the music of which he found could be a link with the past.
I realized that all the flute melodies in the traditional form are derived from vocal music. A traditional performer said, listen to the vocal music and the chants, and then you'll find your flute songs there.
He played alone and in combination with jazz and orchestral ensembles, sometimes using electronic instruments. By 1998, he had over 30 recordings and had sold over 2.5 million records worldwide.
You know how it is when you meet someone who is from a different culture and who is very prominent.
Udi Bar David sought Nakai out about 3 years ago with the idea of playing together as part of an intercultural journey.
I went to his house in Tucson. He asked me, so what's your plan? I said, I had no plan. I just took a flight and I came to meet with you.
I asked him to bring his cello into the house and took out my flute.
He has many flutes that were made for him.
And I said, much of it will be improvisatory, so if you can improvise, then we may be able to originate some melodies of one kind or another.
Improvisation, a natural part of the music of many cultures, was not originally part of the discipline for classically trained Bar David. He says he found his way with a little help from a friend, African-American jazz musician Diane Monroe.
She's the one who actually gave me the courage to improvise. I was so afraid of making mistakes, and she said, just play one note. So, you know, I started with one note, and then she was kind of pushing me, and then the notes turned into two notes, and then three notes, and then all of a sudden there was this freedom, and the fingers just started going with the harmonies and with what you hear, and it's just a matter of opening up.
And so, in a house in Arizona, Bar David and Nakai got to know one another, conversing through music.
As we played and I changed from one minor key to the other, then it seemed that it all would work very well.
Bar David likens musical exchange to a conversation in which each person introduces himself, and then by sharing and listening, they find out what they have in common.
I found those Native American sounds meeting the Middle Eastern sounds, which was my comfort zone, and his comfort zone is Native American. And that's how the conversation started. And then gradually, as we were listening to each other, we started absorbing each other's musical identity, which in essence is cultural identity as well. And the conversation turned into a unit. I do believe that it's a creation of an art form where two cultures meet. Improvisation is a great bridge.
This third art form is a musical language that is new, yet respects and draws from individual elements of each tradition. Over the last 3 years, the musical conversation between Bar David and Nakai has continued and evolved. They've developed a number of programs for intercultural journeys and made a CD called Voyagers. It includes a prayer from Jewish life.
It starts with cello alone, and then Nakai responds to it. So he brings his world into it, and we really made something out of the prayer that ended up as a conversation between Native America and the Jewish world.
While some conversations are prayerful and soulful, others, like Indigenous Indigena, are downright playful.
When he starts something, I come in, and I come in with my identity, which includes my culture and my Middle Eastern background, and then it completely takes a new form, which is based on that conversation.
The works sound Native American and Middle Eastern, and something that is brand new, as each tradition pushes forward.
Of what I work in is getting people to realize that indigenous cultures are also moving into the 21st century. And while we too have a traditional classical background of vocal music performance, we are now exploring the capabilities of the new instrumentation and new philosophies that have come from the rest of the world since 1491.
And I really believe that our identity, personal and artistic, is the sum of everything we experience, and I think it does change.
Borrowing musical elements from other cultures is not new. Intercultural Journey's upcoming program with the Philadelphia Orchestra highlights the sounds of Native America that delighted Dvorak and influenced his New World Symphony. Yet the goal of Intercultural Journeys is not merely to make entertaining new music. It's hoped that musical conversations can prompt dialogue beyond music, that they can lead to an understanding of what we have in common and greater interest in, appreciation for, and trust about what we do not.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. In a program that also features works by Dvorak and DeMars, the Philadelphia Orchestra performs Or Carlos Nakai's Fourth World Rainbow World with Intercultural Journeys in a family concert on Saturday, November 22nd at 11:30 a.m. and in an access concert on Tuesday, November 25th at 7 p.m. Both events take place at Verizon Hall at the Kimmel Center and are conducted by orchestra assistant conductor Danail Ratchev. From its grand opening on December 14, 2001, the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts has been one of Philadelphia's most celebrated, yet most controversial structures. While many believe the Kimmel has helped Philadelphia regain its position as a musical mecca, others have criticized its cost, its acoustics, and its architecture. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores how a new management team and outside consultants are working to recreate the Kimmel from the inside out.
At 3 o'clock on a busy Thursday afternoon, the Kimmel Center is an oasis of deserted calm. While traffic hurries by outside on South Broad Street, fewer than half a dozen people, mostly employees, linger in the Kimmel's lobby. Commonwealth Plaza, envisioned as a bustling, lively public space, appears nearly desolate. But Natalie Paquin, the Kimmel's executive vice president and chief operating officer, foresees a day when the plaza will live up to its promise.
When the Kimmel Center was envisioned, it was envisioned to be a cultural mecca. It was also envisioned that many people during the day and during other periods of the day would come and just gather in our building. And so the lobby area is called Commonwealth Plaza, and it was envisioned that that would be a large gathering place for people to experience other aspects of the arts.
The Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, home to the Philadelphia Orchestra, opened after a 15-year gestation, which saw the replacement of its original designers, Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, with architect Raphael Vignoli. Vignoli's design, which threw a soaring glass vault over the center's interior, was generally admired, but many observers consider the Kimmel to be poorly executed and unwelcoming to the public. Among them is Harris Steinberg, head of Penn Praxis, an architectural design laboratory associated with the University of Pennsylvania.
It should be one of the great public spaces of the city. It should be a place like 30th Street Station, Reading Terminal Market, the court at Wanamaker's that the public feels both awed and at home. And I think it's awe-inspiring but chilly once you go in there.
Initial attempts to improve the Kimmel were hampered by a lawsuit with Vignoli, settled out of court, and a $30 million construction debt. In 2006, the Kimmel hired Natalie Pekin, chief operating officer of the School District of Philadelphia, as its own COO. Last year, Ann Ewers, former head of the Utah Symphony and Opera, came on board as the Kimmel's president and CEO. Within a year, the new management team has retired the center's $30 million debt and raised the endowment from $40 to $72 million. Yet when Ewers spoke with WRTI shortly after her appointment, bringing people to the center outside of performance hours was also high on her to-do list.
We're meant to be a destination location. Why aren't we having more daytime activity? Why is this place not booming?
As well as asking for suggestions from her own board and staff as to how to bring life to the plaza, Ewers also looked at proposals from Harris Steinberg and Penn Praxis, according to Natalie Pekin.
We really wanted to know before we embark on any new initiatives, how do we move forward?
The Penn Praxis design recommendations, released to the public last spring, range from the simple, installing comfortable seats and an indoor-outdoor cafe, to the ambitious, building an eight-story spiral staircase that connects to all levels of the Kimmel, to the whimsical, placing a rock-climbing wall in the lobby. Steinberg admits that bringing the Kimmel Center to life was not an easy task for his students.
It's a tough problem to adaptively reuse an existing building that cost $250 million, $100 million of which were public money, that was meant to be the anchor of the Avenue of the Arts, but in many ways is the emperor has no clothes. How do you start to put clothes on the emperor?
The findings from the Penn Praxis initiative are now being evaluated as part of a long-term strategic plan for physically improving the Kimmel. Work has already begun on some of the simpler suggestions. Pekin is particularly proud of a new layout for the lobby area across from the bar.
What you have here is four or five different seating areas with comfortable sofas and umbrellas and tables with green plants that will go along the side of Verizon Hall. If you were to come in during the day or pre- and post-performance, there are gathering spaces for the public to have small conversations and really enjoy the space a little bit more.
While humanizing the Kimmel's interior poses a challenge, Harris Steinberg believes that the long-term payoff could be tremendous for both the center and its guests.
The potential to enliven that space, I think, is tremendous. How do we now use it as a kind of springboard for reimagining the Kimmel for the next couple of decades?
Philadelphians had to wait decades for a concert hall that lived up to their perception of what a world-class city deserves. With luck, the wait will not be as long for an arts center that welcomes them day or night, whether they've come to enjoy a concert, an espresso, or just an innocent flirtation.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.